on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The Korean War ceasefire took place 60 years ago. July 27th, 1953 was the date. And our guest today survived unthinkable conditions as a prisoner of war during the Korean War.
Ken Eaton is the author of Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. We're going to talk more about it. And I thought I would read you the dedication of this book. I'm really struck by the first page of the book and the last page. On the last page, you see a picture of Ken and his wife, Diane, when they were married. And it mentions their four children, 10 grandchildren, and 11 great-grandchildren, 25 people who would have never been born had he not survived 32 months as a prisoner of war during the Korean War. The front page has this dedication. It says, "This book is dedicated to those 8,126 men who were missing in action or prisoners of war and have not yet been recovered, according to Department of Defense statistics, and also to my dear mother, whose faith in God and his ability to bring me home safely never wavered. God was faithful to bring him home. Those other men never did get to come home." And I imagine there were countless times where you thought you were going to be one of those guys who never came home. We talked about you being captured. You escaped three times, only to be captured again. Never once were you actually executed. How many times did you think that's what was going to happen to you?
Well, each time I escaped, that would be the inevitable. They would execute you for that. Generally, the guard that followed, if he was the one that we called Geronimo, he had a round face and very heavily pockmarked, and him and three or four followed the main group always behind to just catch those who was trying to escape or became too sick to continue. He took care of the wounded in that way. He'd shoot them. And that went on time and time again. In my presence, I seen that happen to other GIs who escaped and was caught, and they'd shoot them. I can only say that God and my luck and my ability to speak a little bit of the Japanese language to talk to these people saved me from being executed each time I escaped, because the threat was always there. In fact, is the second time I escaped, I dug my own grave. Well, partially dug it until I got to talk in Japanese to these two North Korean soldiers, impress them with the possibility. I think they thought I was a downed pilot. And when they had recaptured me, and it would be a feather in their hat to turn me over to their superiors, perhaps, and that stopped them from shooting me and making me finish burying and digging my own grave.
But that whole time, you're digging that grave. You're dealing with this emotion, this fear that this is it. I can't imagine what that must feel like to be digging your own grave and knowing that pretty soon, in just a few moments, you're going to be in there. Did you feel any sense of encouragement, comfort from somewhere that, you know, gave you that little inkling of hope that maybe this wasn't going to be it for you?
How your mind really works under circumstances like that, it's human nature for one to try to find a way out. You're thinking as fast as you can, analyzing every direction you look and every person around you, trying to figure out how you're going to get out of the problem you're in. And for fear to interfere with that, you're a loser. And it just didn't seem to happen to me. I don't think it happens to anyone under those circumstances, actually. They're trying to find a way out of what's happening.
And your book doesn't pull any punches that I know of. There's some intense detail in there. There are things that I think really for most of us are unimaginable, but you bring it to life. And I don't know how much you want to get into that in this interview, but I want to give you the opportunity to give our listeners a real sense of what you endured, with the knowledge that you weren't the only one that endured this. And I know that's one of the reasons you wrote this book. And I say it's a new book, Missing Dog Tags, because it's been published this year. But you wrote it within 5 or 6 years of coming home from your days as a prisoner of war. So it's a new book and an old book at the same time for you. Give us a sense, if you can, wherever you're willing to go, with the worst that your captors did to you. I remember one narrative in there about you waking up and there are your captors standing over you, urinating on your face. I mean, that's just a taste of some of the things. What was the worst for you, the hardest for you to endure?
Well, I think the hardest for me to endure was the actual death march. I was with something in excess of 700 soldiers, and that was all Americans. Well, some mixed UN, but very little mixed UN, and no South Koreans. And the starvation would take such a toll on us that there were so many young fellas. I was 20, and there was many 17-year-olds. Everybody had matted beards full of lice, and you couldn't tell how old anyone was. But on talking to them, you'd find out that they were kids. And the fact that the starvation to start after a couple of months took such heavy toll, we would have guys who would get down to where they wouldn't even eat a little bit that they were given. And we called it the big eye, that we'd be sitting in a room on these layovers in these villages, and one would get the big eye, and generally that person would be dead by the following morning. When we'd wake up, he'd just be sitting up against the wall or wherever he was at, and we would know the night before that we're going to lose him. And you couldn't, if you gave him a steak, he would need it, and he'd fight you for bothering him. That was maybe ranks close to anything that maybe happened to me, is to be in that situation time and repeatedly, time and time again, staying in these villages over during the day when my friends and these young fellows would die that away from starvation.
And there's one point in the book where you talk about how many days you had been in captivity, and you talk about seeing someone die at least once a day, people that you either knew or were around, and you witnessed that. And you talk about the death march. Put in perspective for our listeners how long this death march lasted, how much ground you covered, and the conditions you had to deal with, because it wasn't just starvation that threatened to end your life.
Well, I was captured 15 miles south of the 30th parallel, and I don't know the exact mileage, but some of the officers thought we were going to walk 500 miles to get to the Yali River. I since have been told that we walked between 250 and 300 miles on a starvation diet, which was the walking was killing us, because of if the they only fed us if they found any kind of grain in these villages where the North Korean people had left because of fear of the North Korean soldiers. And if there's anything left there to be fed, that's what we ate. And if there was nothing there, we didn't eat. And some days we'd go two or three days without a single meal. And then they'd find a village larger with where they could feed us two meals a day for two or three days till they had to move out again. And then it was just up and down. One day you get a meal, the next day you'd get two, the next day two or three days you might not get any. And that's what took the largest toll on us. But in answer to your question, it's back to the death march and the starvation and our own airplanes. We were strafed many times by our own airplanes. They would be en route back to their base, still have ammo in their planes, and they would dive down on the villages to see if there was a Russian truck or any North Korean soldiers or Chinese there, and they'd strafe a few houses, and if anybody ran out, then they would maybe rocket and bomb and strafe a lot more if there's three or four planes. But the Chinese impressed us with the fact that if you come out of the house, when we get strafed, our guards will shoot you because they're dug in all around the buildings until they move us out in the evenings. And so you had to stay inside, and our own planes would kill us that way, and they didn't know it.
You know. So you guys are inside these houses, shoulder to shoulder, on the floor, up against the walls, everywhere, knowing that somebody's going to die and praying that the bullets, the shrapnel, whatever, isn't going to hit you. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, that's a fair assessment of what would take place. You just wouldn't know. A couple of times, I would try to bum we would find leaf tobacco when they move us into these villages. Sometimes if the place had a manger where they had, if several of them owned an oxen there that worked the fields or pulled the carts, well, they would grow leaf tobacco or buy it from another village perhaps, and it'd be dried in bundles out in the manger hanging up, and we'd find that and tear paper off the walls and make, if we didn't have any propaganda paper, to roll and make a cigarette to smoke. And at those times, one time I moved to the outside edge of the building because we were being strafed, and a queen, one of the drivers of my second tank, who got knocked out first, was still alive, and he had told me earlier that he had found some tobacco a couple of days earlier, had some in his pocket, and I just had to have a smoke. I was so nervous about what was going on. And it, only one time a plane had come down, but it was P-51s, propel craft, and they come straight down. They don't strafe like a jet, and they just scream bloody murder, and it's that alone will just almost kill you, the fear of what's going to happen when he gets closer to that village and starts pulling a trigger and firing those 50s and 30 caliber machine guns off his wings and the nose of his plane in the building. But at this particular time, they killed about 15 guys and wounded about 30, and they're in about 35 or 40 houses. The Chinese moved us out when that wing of planes left, knowing they would send someone back because someone had been outside and attracted them. And when we came back off the side of the hill later on that afternoon, when the planes finally didn't come anymore, there was about 15 or maybe 16 bodies thrown in a ravine right next to the building. They were just throwing them in like they were stacking cordwood.
And this became your daily experience, something that you were just faced with day in, day out. So there was the starvation. There was the exhaustion of marching, eventually 250 miles. There was the friendly fire from American aircraft dive bombing and strafing you on a daily basis. And then there was the weather. I mean, people in World War II talk about the Battle of the Bulge and how brutal that winter was. You guys were dealing with conditions just as bad, if not worse, 40, 50 below zero?
Yes, 40, 50. Even the winter of 50 and the 51, up until the end of February or maybe even the middle of March, that far north got 60 below. Many guys died with gangrene from having frozen feet because they couldn't get dry their feet or didn't have more socks to change like we'd had on the front lines, or had forced to wade through water, and then their feet would freeze, or they'd give us one break a night, but the break would last anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, and we'd just freeze when we should have been up walking, instead of having a break that long and around midnight at night, and the guys would get feet would be black, gangrene would set in above the feet that had been frozen, and with no doctors to take care of us, ultimately a lot of those guys died. A lot of guys lost their feet, lost their toes, even some guys lost their hands because they didn't keep their hands warm from the sub-zero weather.
And the more I hear about that, the more I read in your book, the more I'm amazed that you survived and you're in the kind of shape you're in today, turning 84 tomorrow. Ken Eaton is our guest today. His book, Missing Dog Tags, describes many of the things we've talked about in captivating detail, and some of the stuff he just mentioned with the frozen feet, the frozen extremities, some of the more stomach-turning moments of that book. But it hits home for you, the price that has been paid for our freedom, what length some people have gone and some people have endured to make sure that we are a free country and that we promote that freedom around the world. When we come back, we'll get more of Mr. Eaton's story, tell you more about how you can get the book, Missing Dog Tags. It's a Korean War edition of Hometown Heroes today.
And we'll come down the home stretch right after this. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Los Banos. That's where I grew up, and I'm guessing Los Banos is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Sito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous.
I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.